Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This week's podcast concerns wire removal. Mike Seymour is going to talk with Aaron Rhodes, who's roto paint supervisor at the orphanage. This Art of Wire Removal is part of our Art of series, which if you're looking for in-depth information about some of the technologies we use in visual effects, we've been doing these Art of series. And if you want to find them, there's an easy way. On the FX Guide homepage, there's a bar across the top with home, feature stories, quick takes, kind of a quick navigation bar. If you go to that and hit feature stories, it's a three-column display. Recent stories on the left, FX Guide recommends in the middle, and most popular on the right. The FX Guide recommends contains a list, usually, of the Art of series along with some other articles. For example, Art of HDR, Art of Keying, Art of Tracking. These are all part of the Art of series that we've been doing, and I think you'll find them very interesting. Art of Optical Flow, Tracking, just really in-depth breakdowns of the history and the science of each one of these technologies and as we use them in visual effects. Before we get to that interview, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the new term at FXPhD. There's so many classes this term I'm personally interested in. There's like 21 classes, I think, 21 classes. Digital photography's new. There's a DV Rebel class. There's an Apple Color class. This one's new. This one got added very late in the planning, but very excited to be offering an Apple Color class. Also, a Smoke and Flame, both using the new 2008 releases, classes. And, of course, there's Nuke classes. There's a new Fusion class, a new ZBrush class. So many classes. There's really just a wealth. If you're looking to expand your skill set or looking to get into the industry, either way, or just learn some new areas, new skills. Let's say you're a Flame guy and you want to learn some Nuke, or let's say you're just getting interested in visual effects. Well, photography is kind of a fundamental principle to what we do. So a photography class is something we've wanted to do from the very beginning. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it too long. I just wanted to say I think Mike and John are doing an amazing job. Each term just keeps getting better. And one thing I wanted to point out that a lot of people don't seem to know when I talk to them about FXPhD, when you sign up, you can sample from all the classes the first couple weeks. All the details are on the site. You've got to check out the details to find out the timing of all this. But you can actually go through all the classes. You can sign up for your first classes and say you're on the fence about a couple. Which ones you want to do, because there's so many to choose from. You can actually select your classes, and then in the first 2 weeks of the term, watch any of the classes and sample them and decide, kind of just like in a university, where you can sample the classes and then lock down your schedule for the rest of the term. Anyway, on this week's podcast, let's get into that. Mike and Aaron are going to discuss wire removal, and this is something that's just gotten more and more complicated as it's gotten more and more easy. You know, in the old days, there were little tiny wires, and the production side really tried to shake down those wires and make them almost invisible to begin with on the set. That was kind of the goal. Now, since we have more technology, there's times when the wires have gotten to be climbing ropes, huge, and this poses new problems. Anyway, Mike and Aaron are going to discuss all the details of this. And like I said, this is part of the Art of series, so you really want to check out the whole Art of series on FXGuide.com. Let's cross over to Mike and Aaron now and talk about wire removal.
So you're at the orphanage and the northern part of California, is that right? Or are you up in Canada?
We're in San Francisco, or my office is in San Francisco.
But
we have a few offices, one in L.A., primarily heading up the acquisitions and the kind of the business side of acquiring films, and San Francisco has the meat of the work that we do in terms of visual effects. And we also have a Canadian office up in Vancouver that can be expanded to if necessary.
So I was very keen to talk to you today because we're really interested in the role and shots done by teams that do rig and wire removal. And you obviously have a lot of experience in that area.
Yeah, I've been a roto paint supervisor for the last 4+ years, ranging on shows from Spy Kids 3D all the way up to our most recent Productions, Die Hard 4, and currently in production, Iron Man.
Now, the thing about wire removal and rig removal is that there is, I guess, a perception amongst some that that's not a bad entry-level place to come in. But yet, it's certainly my experience that you need a very deep understanding of 2D and 3D to work out the optimum solution when you move past anything but simple kind of wire removal. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that with most disciplines, there are, you know, ranges of difficulty. There are definitely plenty of things that an entry-level artist can handle that fall into the scope of roto and paint, such as dirt removal, which is not it's probably the least glamorous, but it's definitely something that is a necessary process. There's simple roto and there's simple paint to just remove kind of problematic, you know, items on a set that are pretty stationary, that are pretty straightforward to remove, and it can range all the way up to wires and rigs and harnesses that cross in front of action, in front of extremely hard to recreate backgrounds. So you definitely have a large cross-section of skill sets that are needed for any given production.
So let's talk about that Die Hard sequence, for example. You've got, just as an example, there's the elevator sequence. Obviously, there's a real elevator rig that's been set up. It's got an actual kind of SUV suspended, and it's a set. So what, you had three sides that you could have at any one time, or removable sides on that lift shaft?
It was, you know, I wasn't actually on set for that shoot, but it seemed to me that they had pretty much an enclosure that had windows that a camera could peek its head out of at various points within the shaft. The shaft was probably perhaps a story tall, maybe a story and a half. So it was a fairly large structure and set that they created. And to be able to shoot from any given angle, you would have, you know, wires or the contraption that held the SUV to the wall that had a hydraulic rig to angle it at different degrees, cabling to secure actors so they wouldn't plummet to their death. So you had a bunch of things that are necessary for the shoot to preserve action as well as to preserve life that had to be dealt with in post. There's no way around it.
So in a situation like that, clearly, you know, in the old days, if you go back maybe 5-10 years ago, someone would have said, we want to have a lot of locked off shots so it's easy to do things. This day and age, it's the exact opposite. There's a huge amount of energy in the camera moves. And as a consequence, you're going to have some fairly hairy wire removal. And yet, and I'm not picking on Die Hard by any stretch of the imagination, but obviously there is now a sort of a presumption that a team is going to be able to remove those rigs and wires. And yet they are actually quite tricky, aren't they?
Absolutely. No, they're definitely... What I find so interesting is that, you know, Die Hard, the hype before the release and during the release is, you know, it got back to the roots of doing a production the right way or the old school way of pretty much having real special effects. And the difference between special and visual effects is special effects happen on set. And so they launched a cop car, from my understanding, into a helicopter. Perhaps the helicopter wasn't, you know, actually floating in air on its own, but they literally smashed up stuff, which is, you know, kind of that old filmic way of creating visual effects or special effects. But yeah, in today's kind of fast and furious production, they do sometimes and more often than not, overlook how much time and effort it takes to remove that one wire. That if they just put it on the backside of Bruce Willis instead of in the front of him, they could have saved thousands of dollars and you know, tens of hours for an artist to do. their labor to remove it.
So let's talk about approaches in general to wire removal shots. And we'll work our way from obviously the most simple to the more complex and computer assisted. And in the simplest sort of sense of the, you know, technique, if there is a wire that's a microfilament that's occasionally flashing, you can just paint a frame, right? Because, I mean, if it's not there constantly, there's nothing wrong with actually just, you know, good old-fashioned paint.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the best technique of all, is to try and, you know, use these assistants, these wires to assist your shooting decisions and performances, but to use monofilament instead of two-inch wire that's going to show up. So at least you could, like you say, remove the glints of sunlight hitting the monofilament as opposed to the entire wire. So there's definitely techniques that are used on set to minimize our post work. But yeah, my philosophy is let's do high quality work, but let's try and minimize the amount so that, you know, the part of filmmaking is the illusion of storytelling, to make someone believe what they are seeing is true. And you don't necessarily need to recreate everything as if it were perfect. Sometimes you can get away with just removing those glints and still having a little bit of monofilament visible. It's about getting it to that point where it is, you know, high quality work, and if you look at it, you don't see the cable. But if you can massage it in such a way that you're not spending 50 hours removing that wire, and you're spending 30 hours, and it sells itself. That's what I want to do, to move the production along. So that's a tricky balance to play, because you need to have that wire removed completely in order to sell it to the DP, who is, you know, absolutely pinpointed on, like, I know, I shot it there, it was there. And A-being with the plate is a constant reminder of that type of quality that we need to adhere to. And with DVD multi-angle releases and seeing, you know, the behind the scenes of Sin City is awesome. To be able to alternate between the original green screen plate and the final shot, it's awesome. But you can start to see that movie magic, you know, kind of revealed, that kimono that opens up. You can start to see what makes that ninja tick.
So let's work our way through sort of techniques. And of course, we should highlight that it isn't just wires, because quite often, even if they're wearing harnesses beneath their clothes, there are ways the clothes are being pulled by the rigs that sometimes have to be adjusted. There's also shadows from cables that are almost just as bad as the cables themselves, sometimes worse because they're no longer a straight line. So, you know, it's not a simple process, but let's assume for a second that we've got some cables we're trying to remove and work our way through. We've got simple paint. I think probably what the next one would be, taking a shot that's moving and literally stabilizing it, then using the fact that we now have some kind of stability in the shot to wire removal based on previous and aft frames, and then of course reintroducing the move again so that for a brief moment there, when we've got it stabilized, you can actually use the correlation between frames. But of course, once you move it again, that doesn't become apparent to the user.
Yeah, the stabilization technique that you mentioned is definitely it's a great tool to be able to use it, but it doesn't come without a lot of time to A, stabilize it accurately, and then to take into account that motion blur that's happening when you reintroduce the motion back into the plate. It can get extremely tricky to recreate that motion blur accurately. I know on a shot with for Superman Returns, we had a cable that came in front of Superman while he was landing at a hospital, and the cable came in front of him and the actress he was carrying, and we did several techniques on that shot to remove it, but stabilization was one of them. Morphing was a second, and just hunkered down, painted frame by frame was a third. I think that one aspect that we've shifted our kind of the trend of our the style of work that we've done has been to move away from that frame by frame paint technique and to proceduralize things. Stabilization helps you see an image in a easier fashion to be able to patch out certain areas, put it in, and then reintroduce the motion. But to proceduralize a patch on an arm, so instead of painting frame by frame, you have a patch that you track in, is so much more flexible in the end than painstakingly trying to get shadows and shading and roll off and motion blur through the end of a paintbrush. To proceduralize it really has innovated our technique and increased our potential quite a bit.
Now, one of those procedural techniques, which is both one that can be done manually and then has made its way into automated systems, is to literally sort of clone over from a part next to. So you could either define the effectively a roto shape of where the line is and either in paint, so paint from the outsides to the center, or literally just lift some texture from beside it and put it over the top. And while that sounds like a terrific technique, it gets you only partway there because, of course, that then screws up on edges, doesn't it, when it doesn't actually line up and making sure the tonality of a shot, like you've described over an arm where you have subtle roll-offs in tone, don't show up is actually excruciatingly difficult.
Yeah, it's a two-stage process. It's you can use those automated tools to get 20% solved, but then you have to go and remove the removal line, which is the 80% left on the shot. But it is a good place to start because then you can get the bulk of it, you can see where you're at, and really stand back from the shot and say, what's important here? Where are the shades coming in that are important to preserve? What could I remove? And again, it's, you know, most often you get into these cul-de-sacs of trying to recreate exactly what was behind, where in most cases, if you just take that reality and flight it a little bit into kind of an imaginary recreation, you can get so much done so much more faster.
So then we have these more automated versions of what we've discussing, such as the Foundry with their furnace plugins, and increasingly things like planar trackers that we're seeing come, you know, Moki, Monet, and Mocha and stuff. Mm-hmm. And did you use any sort of third-party stuff like that on recent productions?
You know, I've done quite a bit of testing some of those automated roto types of tools, which totally come in handy in a pinch. In the end, you know, it gets you very close. And I would say that it could be used on a standard def commercial, perhaps, for quick turnaround, and you're kind of riding the line more so on the unbelievable than the kind of the like I was talking about earlier with regards to not necessarily going for full reality. You kind of, with these automated tools, you can't just leave them as a standalone, in my opinion. You need to go in and tweak secondarily to those results. But they're really cool. Definitely, you know, it makes you think that you could literally draw 3 points of a spline around a car and say, go, and have it get, you know, 40% close to finishing a rotomat line. It doesn't really cut it when you've got, you know, extremely three-dimensional subjects, such as a hand reaching out to a to a camera with hair going over a jungle background. It just doesn't work to automate that stuff. So the automated tools are really great to get you partially there, and is awesome for previs and for maybe quick commercials, but it doesn't hold up for 2K, in my opinion, for the full ride. So I would say you could use portions of them for portions of a show, but not for the full Monty.
And then we move, I guess, to the sort of the next level, which is if we're moving away now from like 2D automated or manual kind of solutions, then there's the, well, heck, the background's so mucked up, let's cut out the actor in the foreground. In your case, the guy with the hand forward with the greenery behind. And that's then either, you know, do a matte painting or a digital simulation or a 3D, you know, new jungle and place it back behind them. And sure. And that's a technique that's very common, isn't it? It's like basically say, well, the only thing we need out of this shot for 100% real is that actor. And we can then basically clean up almost like a still and put it back in and then add motion to it again.
Yeah, you know, which I think has led us to films such as Sky Captain and Sin City, where they're like, you know what, why start with the jungle? Let's just shoot it in a warehouse in front of a green screen. It'll be perfect. But, you know, that's part of the cool thing about films is that they're not perfect. You know, maybe the jungle doesn't move in the wind the way that the director really wants it to on that particular day, but that's cool. But yeah, you can absolutely. We've had multiple cases where, there was a specific shot on Die Hard that wouldn't look like a huge visual effect shot, but it was pretty time consuming. There was a cable attached to one of the cars that crashed down from the overpass, and a car wiping the foreground. And there was a wire attached to the car that was wiping the foreground, trailing behind it a bunch of dust and a bunch of junk. And we needed to remove the wire as well as all of the dust and keep some of the junk. And we ended up needing to replace the entire street instead of just... it was just much easier to literally cut out the foreground car, remove the wire, keep some of the junk, but then you had this flash of dust on the junk that you were trying to preserve. So it was a bunch of color correction and adding in CG junk, and not to mention the fallen overpass in the far back. So,
well, as you say, I mean, the 2.5D solution of, well, let's see if we... I mean, a classic case, and I saw this in a job, we had a ninja type person leaping up and the camera panned around, there was bamboo behind them. It was just easier to get successive frames of bamboo and paint them into 2D backdrop and then 2.5D it in behind them again than it was to try and remove the wires over the bamboo. But you guys didn't stop there, because you went to full sort of 3D reconstruction, and so instead of just having 2.5D, you really had sort of 3D replacement behind to solve problems, right?
Yeah, in the elevator shaft sequence, it wasn't easy to do, but it was easier to literally cut out the falling SUV from the elevator shaft and either project just one wall in a kind of a... It was a full-on 3D... depends, actually. We solved it multiple ways using After Effects 3D, which would be a 2.5D solution, and or literally running out a CG wall for a portion that we needed to replace. So there were multiple shots like that, and where it got very apparent that we needed to solve it in 3D was when the camera would whip pan straight up, looking up the elevator shaft, track the car falling down, and literally go, you know, a little less than 180 degrees looking down the elevator shaft. That's where we said, you know, the 2D solution or 2.5D solution is not going to work super well. So that's when we did a 2.5D or 3D solution.
And so in the scheme of things, obviously computers get faster and there is new software, but it's sounding to me like there's an innovation at the artist level, but still an enormous amount of just problem solving to tackle something like the Die Hard elevator scene, and almost on a shot-by-shot basis.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was shot-by-shot, and it wasn't necessarily understood when we were first getting into it that it was going to be as challenging as it was, or which shots were going to be particularly more difficult or challenging than others. But it was through review and turning over the shots that we realized, oh, there's a camera crew underneath the SUV in this shot that we didn't see when we're originally looking at the shots when we're bidding the shots, or even when we first got the shots. So it was definitely an evolutionary process that the supervisors went through, that the artists went through, that they would bring things to our attention. You know, I don't know how many times after turning over a shot, I've seen through review saying, wait a minute, what's that doing in this shot? So we have to go back through and figure out new solutions for different problems. So.
Now, Tommy, one thing I was going to ask you about, we mentioned shadows, obviously, is another contributing factor from rigs and wires, but did in a car spot, did you also have reflection problems with rigs?
Yeah, I mean, cars have lots of reflective things on them, like windshields, side panels, the headlight reflector things. The back window, I think, was probably the primary culprit of that SUV when we're pointing down, since it's a flat plane. It would reflect the camera, or I don't know why they put these things on cameras, the little red light saying that it's recording, because you know you're going to need to remove that if you're going to see it. So
a piece of advice, if you're on set and you're going to do rig removal, at least get a piece of gaffer tape and put it over the record light, eh?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us and stepping through. It obviously has been exquisitely painstaking work, but by the same token, you know, watching the sequence in the cinema, it is easy to just be involved with the story because the work does become fairly seamless. How big was your team on that project?
We had, you know, I don't know what the full count was. We had a lot of people work on that show. It was probably close to 70 or 80 artists in San Francisco, and maybe about just about 20 up in Canada, perhaps. So it was a major show for us, and it took a lot of sweat, blood, and tears to get through it.
Well, Aaron, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks again to Aaron Rhodes at the Orphanage for taking time to talk to us. So that's it for this FX podcast. Like I said before Mike's interview, take a few minutes to check out FX PhD, check out the new term. I think you'll find classes that will stimulate you, interest you, and take your game to the next level. So until next time, I'm Jeff Huser for Mike Seymour and John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.